Hello, and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I don't have a must list again this week, and I miss them when we don't have them. I do have an article to start off with that's the best and worst moments from the 2025 Golden Globes, which was last weekend. All hail Nikki Glaser! And could someone please ask the announcer to zip it? This is by Kristen Baldwin and Christian Haloub. Is it possible? Were the 82nd annual Golden Globes actually kind of fun? Much of the credit goes to host Nikki Glaser, but the official kickoff to award season also had laughs, entertaining speeches, and some solid presenter bits. Of course, the show made us cringe a few times, too. It's the Globes, after all. Please enjoy our full report on the best and worst moments from the 2025 Golden Globes. And there are seven items here. Number one, it's a best. Nikki Glaser shows how it's done. After last year's unfortunate, much maligned opening set from host Joe Coy, fellow stand-up comedian Nikki Glaser, herself a first-time Globes host, had a low bar to clear. But rather than playing it safe, the foremost roast mistress delivered a masterful 10-minute monologue that was hilariously acerbic, pointed, and playful enough to keep the crowd on her good side. It's hard to pick a best punchline. She praised the waitstaff as the hardest working actors in show business, noted that she's seen more actual peacocks than shows on Peacock, and did a pitch perfect impression of Adam Sandler pronouncing Timothée Chalamet with his signature flourish. Her bits continued to kill throughout the night, especially her Conclave and Wicked musical number, Popular. After Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and now Nikki Glaser, it's clear that if you want a Golden Globes hosted right, ask a woman. Next, the worst, presenters forced to back it up. Pulling off a pithy, quick, and memorable bit as a presenter on an awards show is hard enough, so why did Globes producers make it even harder on their stars by making them stand with their backs to a large chunk of the audience? Seth Rogen, who presented the female actor in a limited series category with Catherine O'Hara, did not hide his discomfort. Hello. I want to start by saying this whole angled camera thing is very weird. It's inelegant. It's strange. This whole half of the room can see my bald spot. I would have filled that in. I said no, but I regret that now completely. Fortunately, he and O'Hara played through the positioning pain and delivered an amusing and hilariously long bit about fictional Canadian film awards. Next, it's a best. The Substance stars recreate their rivalry on stage. The shadow of The Substance and its satire of Hollywood's obsession with aging looms large over this year's Golden Globes. The first thing Nikki Glaser did on stage was call the ceremony Ozempic's biggest night, and the host even directly referenced The Substance in a subsequent joke. When Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley, who star in Coralie Farragut's The Substance as an aging star and the younger version of herself, created by the film's titular wonder drug, took the stage to present an award, they couldn't help but fall back into their on-screen dynamic. "What are you doing here? This is my week," Moore joked in reference to the movie's rules. Remember, ladies, you're one. Next, it's a worst. It's mindless chatter. It's a timeless awards show dilemma for producers. How do you keep viewers' attention for those 10 to 15 seconds that a winner is making their way from the table to the stage to accept an award? CBS chose a sort of cable news information overload approach, putting up a caption with very basic information about the winners. Jessica Gunning has an extensive list of credits that includes Doctor Who, White Heat, The Outlaws, and Pride. While Entertainment Tonight host and Globes announcer Kevin Fraser rattled off even less interesting fun facts, aka rehashed bits from his red carpet interviews. Tenenobu Asano told us on the red carpet that he's blown away that Shogun has touched so many people around the world. Trust us, Globe producers, this kind of blather is far more likely to make viewers turn the channel than watching pretty people walk past other pretty people for a few seconds. A best is Colin Farrell stays humble. "No one to thank on this one. I did it all by myself," announced the Penguin star Colin Farrell while accepting his Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Limited Series. Just a raw, pared-away performance. Of course, the lovable Irish actor, who spent 3 hours each day having the prosthetics put on him to play Oswald Cobb, was joking. But Farrell's gratitude for the village of people who helped make the role possible was sincere. He even went so far to thank a devoted craft service staffer who helped him stay cool under all those heavy prosthetics with a steady supply of coconut water. A worst is cutting Ted and Viola for time. On January 3rd, the Golden Globe spent an entire evening honoring two legends of the screen, Viola Davis, winner of this year's Cecil B. DeMille Award, and Ted Danson, winner of the 2025 Carol Burnett Award. Danson's wife, actress Mary Steenburgen, introduced her husband, and none other than Meryl Streep introduced Davis. And yet, we saw none of it. According to the Globe's own press release, the evening offered lengthy clips, introductory remarks, and acceptance speeches that allowed time to give the artists their due, rather than squeeze them into a 45-second slot on a longer awards show. Okay, sure. But for the many Danson and Davis fans watching at home, seeing 45 seconds of these tributes would have been preferable to 0 seconds, which is what we got. Boo! And our last is a best. At long last, no longer furious. Hey, Dwayne. It wasn't much, but those two words, uttered with typical Vin Diesel gruffness, were enough to send the hearts of Fast and Furious fans around the globe into overdrive. Though the much-discussed feud between Diesel and his Fast co-star Dwayne Johnson is apparently no longer raging, Johnson is set to return for another Fast film, we might not have believed the thaw was real if we hadn't witnessed this moment of relative chumminess between the beefy baldies with our own eyes. That was the best and worst moments from the 2025 Golden Globes. It was by Kristen Baldwin and Christian Haloub. Next, I have a couple reviews from the TV section. Severance, Season 2, is more than worth the wait. The Apple TV Plus workplace drama and sci-fi thriller starring Adam Scott returns on January 17th after a nearly 3-year break. This is by Kristen Baldwin. It's taken nearly 3 years for Severance to come back to us, yet somehow it's more relevant than ever. The series follows Mark Scout, played by Adam Scott, a widower who has his work-related memories surgically separated from his personal memories. Lumen Industries, which pioneered quote-unquote Severance, promised Mark that the technology would make his life better. But as he and his severed colleagues discovered, the procedure is part of the conglomerate's unsettling plan to consolidate their control over the global labor force. Now the lauded Apple TV Plus drama from creator Dan Erickson returns with a briskly paced sophomore season that refines its many themes into a timely, rewarding, and challenging debate about power and parameters of personhood. The new season, premiering January 17th, opens 5 months after Mark and his macro data refinement department co-workers, Helly R., played by Britt Lauer, Dylan, played by Zach Cherry, and Irving, played by John Turturro, alerted the world to the exploitation of severed workers, also known as innies. Lumen, following a recognizable corporate playbook, publicly promises vast reforms to the controversial program, including new incentives like pineapple bobbing and additional snacks to the company vending machines. Though suspicions of Lumen's intentions and the daunting assurances of a fresh start from supervisor Mr. Milchick, played by Trammell Tillman, any Mark willingly returns to MDR and resumes his search for Ms. Casey, played by Deacon Lackman, the woman he now knows to be the presumed dead wife of his outside self. Once back in the office, Mark encounters new faces, including severed floor employees Mark W., played by Bob Balaban, and Gwendolyn, played by Aaliyah Shawkat, prepubescent deputy manager Ms. Huang, played by Sarah Bach, towering Lumen enforcer Mr. Drummond, played by Derry Olafson, and a stern cowbell-wielding Lumenite named Lorne, played by Gwendolyn Christie. But the true revelations come above ground, as the story devotes more time to the Audis and their loved ones. Audi Mark, enraged that his former Lumen boss Ms. Coble, played by Patricia Arquette, masqueraded as his neighbor, reluctantly agrees to stay at the company until he and his sister, Devon, played by Jen Tulloch, can figure out what's really going on in that basement he disappears to 8 hours every day. Dylan and his wife, Gretchen, played by Merritt Weaver, work opposite schedules while raising their three kids, and Irving seeks to understand his innie's connection to Bert, played by Christopher Walken, a former employee of Lumen's optics and design department. In the wake of Helly's role in the MDR revolt, Helena Egan, daughter of Lumen CEO Jamie Egan, played by Michael Syberry, does damage control with her ghastly father and engages in a power struggle with Ms. Coble. The more we learn about the Audis, and the more they learn about their innies, the harder it is to deny that Mark, Helly, Dylan, and Irv each comprise two distinct and worthy individuals. In Season 2, Severance forces both its characters and its viewers to confront our ugly tendency to assess another's worth based primarily on how that person's needs and desires align with our own. Though they're being exploited themselves, Mark and his fellow Audis realize the dreadful power they possess over their other selves, who are just one resignation away from annihilation. That looming sense of trepidation is only strengthened by the nuanced performances of the series' stellar leads. Scott manages subtle but identifiable differences in voice and cadence and bearing between Mark S., optimistic innie, and the grief-beaten man who spawned him. Cherry titrates Dylan's Audi with notes of resignation and resentment, and Turturro bolsters outside Irv, a lonely artist, with genial warmth. Nowhere is the dichotomy more evident than Helly and Helena, elegantly individuated by Lower. On the severed floor, Helly is thoughtful, wry, and compassionate, while Helena Egan is calculating and inscrutable. Her chilly showdowns with Ms. Coble, though brief, are some of the best scenes of the season. The new season also gives Tillman a welcome boost in screen time as Mr. Milchick works to maintain his hold on the MDR department while facing unwelcome scrutiny from the imposing Mr. Drummond. Severance's puzzle box narrative spawned dozens of questions in its first season. What happened to Mark's wife, Gemma? What does the microdata refinement department do anyway? And what's the deal with those baby goats? Fear not, some of those answers are forthcoming. One of the 10 episodes this season centers on Gemma and Ms. Casey, and another focuses on Harmony Coble's past and her shocking history with Lumen Industries. There are also some grand additions to the mythology of Keir Egan, played by Mark Geller, Lumen's enigmatic prophet-like founder, and the company's unsettling, somewhat infantilizing corporate culture. Marshmallows are for team players, Dylan. Once again, Jeremy Hindle's impeccable production design is integral to Severance's mood of retro-futuristic ennui, but it's not always clear if the peculiarities of Lumen life are essential for the story or just another chance for a phenomenal visual flourish. Take that goat pasture revealed in the trailer. Are those grassy hills and dales rolling inside a fluorescent-lit square of Lumen office space a metaphor for how capitalism has consumed not just our daily lives, but the planet itself? Or does it just look cool? Only Keir or frequent Severance director Ben Stiller know for sure. At least the goat's purpose is made clear, or clearer, I should say, by the final episode. Of course, one very important mystery remains unsolved. Why did you do this? Mark howls at Miss Coble. What the F is this all about? The season builds to a wrenching and suspenseful finale which reveals some of the specific logistics of Lumen's plan, but the endgame is still frustratingly cryptic. That's what season 3 is for, I suppose. And there is one constant that runs through all this maddening ambiguity, which gives Severance its beautiful, undeniable power. Even in the most punishing of environments, the human heart is undefeated. That was the Severance review. Season 2 is more than worth the wait. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she is giving the show a grade of A-. Our other TV review is The Pit. Noah Wiley anchors a ruthlessly realistic ER drama. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. The second episode of The Pit, the new Max medical drama starring Noah Wiley as the chief attending doctor in an overwhelmed emergency room in Pittsburgh, ends with the grimmest 4 minutes I've ever seen in TV in a while. Just 2 hours into his shift, Dr. Robbie Rabinovich, played by Wiley, must inform a teenager's parents that their son is brain dead after an accidental fentanyl overdose. As the anguished wails from the boy's mother, Lily, played by Samantha Sloyan, echo through the department's halls, a somber Dr. Robbie walks to the next room and reluctantly prepares to insert a breathing tube into an elderly man with dementia, played by Madison Mason. Having failed to convince the man's adult children, played by Rebecca Tilney and Mackenzie Aston, that doing so will only prolong their dying dad's suffering. In another room, student Dr. Whitaker, played by Jaren Howell, insists on continuing chest compressions on his patient, played by David Rivers, because the reality that he just lost his first patient is too much to bear. Then the credits roll. Consider this example both an enticement and a warning. Created by ER alum R. Scott Gemmel, The Pit takes a ruthlessly realistic approach to its depiction of our beleaguered and broken healthcare system, but it's also the most engrossing and addictive medical drama to come along since Grey's Anatomy and, well, ER. The waiting room at Pittsburgh Trauma Medical Hospital is already packed when Dr. Robbie arrives for his shift. And he's barely in the door before Nurses Princess, played by Kristen Villanueva, and Perla, played by Amy Lynn Aberla, start peppering him with questions about rumors that the struggling hospital is going to be sold. They're always threatening to shut us down, but they never do, he assures them. Into this atmosphere of barely controlled chaos walk a gaggle of eager doctors-in-training residents, Melissa King, played by Taylor Dearden, and Trinity Santos, played by Issa Briones, and med students Victoria Javadi, played by Shabana Aziz, and Whitaker, who will spend their first day getting slapped in the face by the ugly and sometimes wrenching realities of working in an undersourced, overcrowded urban hospital. It's a pretty standard setup for a modern medical drama. Dedicated but overworked vets, including Robbie, charge nurse Dana Evans, played by Catherine Lanassa, and senior residents Dr. Langdon, played by Patrick Ball, and Dr. Collins, played by Tracy Ilfaker, lead a group of fresh-faced students through the trial-by-fire pandemonium of their first day on the job. The Pit, premiering January 9th, adds a real-time element to the mix, with each episode chronicling 1 hour in Robbie's 15-hour shift. It's a choice that could come across as gimmicky, but here it adds to the immersive feel of the storytelling, as no one, including viewers, gets more than a few seconds of respite from the frenetic fluorescent lit action. The real-time format also allows Gemmell and his writers to spend multiple hours with patients and the ongoing social issues, including homelessness, caretakers' fatigue, addiction, sex trafficking, and the youth mental health crisis that their cases highlight. Those who like their medical shows to come with more than 10 cc's of romance should probably stick with Grey's Anatomy. The Pitt doesn't make time for love triangles or steamy on-call room hookups, at least not in the 10 episodes released to critics. Instead, we get snatches of personal backstories and glimpses of developing personal dynamics between the characters in the brief pauses between the crises. Robbie is still grieving, though not coping with, the death of his mentor during the COVID pandemic, and he's clearly got some kind of unresolved romantic history with Dr. Collins. In addition to being a child prodigy who started college at 13, Dr. Javadi now has the added pressure of working in the same hospital as her mother, Dr. Shamsi, played by Deepti Gupta, a respected surgeon. Meanwhile, amiable head of triage, Dr. McKay, played by Fiona Dourif, has her moments monitored by an ankle bracelet, for reasons that have yet to be revealed. The Pitt will only work if viewers want to spend 15 hours in close, unchanging quarters with these characters, something that would be difficult to pull off if the cast weren't so good. Wiley, a master at compassionate calm, makes Robbie the perfect counterbalance for the series' often bleak setting. Though beset by soul-breaking external pressures, including frequent scoldings from his boss, Gloria, played by Michael Hyatt, for the hospital's low patient satisfaction scores, Robbie is a bottomless vessel for the pain, anger, fear, frustration, and heartbreak of those around him. Lanassa is immediately endearing as Nurse Evans, a den mother type who ensures that no one, from the anxious med students to the oddball emergency department regulars, feels unsupported in her presence. Dearden is a standout as Dr. King, an earnest, sensitive student whose only ambition is to learn. Howell is heartfelt and amusingly hapless as Whitaker, whose first day features an onslaught of comedic misfortunes. Think George 007 O'Malley from Grey's, or even Wiley's ER character John Carter in his med student days. At this point, it's probably worth noting that the Pitt is currently the subject of a breach of contract lawsuit from the estate of Michael Crichton, who created ER, which claims that the show is a derivative work of the groundbreaking NBC series. We have a quote here: "The Pitt is a completely different show from ER," responds Warner Brothers Television, the studio behind both shows. We'll let the lawyers sort that out, but as a professional TV watcher, I can confirm that almost every medical show since ER, including Pitt, bears at least some of its hallmarks. Plenty of medical dramas have tried to replicate ER in the 31 years since it premiered. Inevitably, they failed. But the Pitt and its characters earn your attention, which is something a mere ripoff couldn't do. Note, this opinion is not admissible in a court of law. Unlike ER, the writing on The Pitt is sometimes clunky. Twice people quote Luke 4:23, "Physician, heal thyself," while talking to Robbie, and the dialogue occasionally veers didactic. Violence against healthcare workers is a national problem. I will also vow to donate blood every year for the rest of my life if TV writers will stop making characters say things like, "In case you didn't realize, I use sarcasm and comedy as a shield," or "so I've been told," as Santos informs Victoria early in the season. Nobody talks like that, folks. These ailments are minor, however, and don't detract from the series' overall creative success. As difficult as The Pitt can be to watch, I'm looking forward to spending another 15 hours in this ER. The Pitt premiered with two seasons on Thursday, January 9th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Max. That was our review of The Pitt. Noah Riley anchors a ruthlessly realistic ER drama It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving the series a grade of A-. Here's a quick article before our break where Heidi Klum will return to Project Runway after 8 years. Auf Wiedersehen is back. This is by Kristen Halub. When Project Runway returns, it'll have a very familiar face back on board. Entertainment Weekly has confirmed that Heidi Klum is returning back to the fashion reality series after an 8-year absence. People was first to break the news. Klum originally hosted Project Runway from its inception in 2004 through 2017. The series focuses on fashion design, with contestants competing to create the best clothes through restrictions on time, materials, and theme. Klum, who bid farewell to cut contestants each week with her signature German sign-off, Auf Wiedersehen, won the 2013 Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Host for a Reality or Reality Competition Program, shared with her longtime co-host Tim Gunn. Klum departed the show at the end of season 16 in 2017, moving with Gunn to the Amazon Prime Video series Making the Cut. Making the Cut has aired 3 seasons so far, the most recent in 2022. During their absence, Project Runway was hosted by Carly Kloss and Christian Siriano. Siriano was the winner of season 4 of the show and remains its most famous alumnus. Project Runway will also be available to watch on new channels. The show originally aired on Bravo before moving to Lifetime from 2009 to 2017. After Klum and Gunn departed, the show moved back to Bravo from 2019 to 2023. Now it will air on Freeform and stream on Hulu and Disney+. Project Runway is an iconic television juggernaut that perfectly complements the pop culture spirit at Freeform, Hulu and ABC executive Simran Sethi said in a statement back in October. We're excited to welcome the original series to the Disney family and reignite the fan base alongside Spyglass and Alfred Street, giving viewers the chance to once again share in discovering the next generation of exceptionally talented fashion designers. Judges and premiere date will be announced later. There's also no word yet on whether Gunn, who Klum has called her TV husband, will also be returning to Project Runway. Representatives for Klum did not immediately respond to Entertainment Weekly's request for further comment. Back in 2020, when Making the Cut premiered, Klum told Entertainment Weekly that the show's focus was more international than the New York-based Project Runway had been. We're finding the next global brand, so this is no longer a sewing competition. The show filmed in Paris and Tokyo and featured Naomi Campbell and Nicole Richie as judges. That was Heidi Klum will return to Project Runway after 8 years. Auf Wiedersehen is back. That was by Kristen Halub. And this is a good time to take that break to say you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. There's a 2025 preview featured on their website these days, and here we are in 2025. The big cover story is about Suits. Case reopened, the unexpected story behind the making of Suits LA. This is by Cindy Buxbaum. There's a goddamn czar on Suits LA. We are limited to 3 goddammits per episode, series creator Aaron Korsh says of NBC's rules on how much his upcoming Suits spinoff can use the original law drama's favorite expletive in all of its forms. Suits averaged 5 times per episode and once infamously reached 17 when it aired on USA Network. Having it be on a broadcast network as opposed to basic cable, we had to make some changes, Korsh explains, speaking to Entertainment Weekly just days ahead of his first day filming on the new series in Los Angeles after shooting the pilot in Vancouver. They cannot curse, they can't say shit, they can't say F, so you will hear some goddammits, but you won't hear as many as you heard on Suits. And they're all reserved for me, Suits LA star Stephen Amell tells Entertainment Weekly with a grin. sitting on the set in his fake law office's conference room in early December. I was actually filming a scene the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and we had a couple takes where there was no goddamn, and I threw in a goddamn, he adds. I noticed that on the original, I liked it a lot. If you're not going to lean into it, what are you going to do? To borrow a favorite line from Suits legal shark, Harvey Specter, played by Gabriel Macht, you're goddamn right. Suits LA, premiering February 23rd at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time, only exists because the original Suits became one of the hottest things in pop culture in 2023, 4 years after it ended, thanks to the series becoming available to stream on Netflix. To absolutely everyone's surprise, the drama about a con man with a photographic memory, played by Patrick J. Adams, posing as a Harvard-educated lawyer at a top New York City firm, smashed streaming records for months on end. Nielsen reported U.S. viewers watched 57.7 billion minutes in 2023, making it the most viewed series on streaming that year. Suddenly, Suits was bigger than it ever was during its original 9-year run. So you bet your ass the creator leaned into the unexpected resurgence by developing a new show set in the same universe, albeit one in which the characters can't actually say, you bet your ass. Once again written and executive produced by Korsh, who recently signed an overall deal with Universal Content Productions, Suits LA follows a new group of ambitious and attractive lawyers led by Ted Black, played by Arrow and Heels alum ML. The former federal prosecutor from New York has reinvented himself as a powerful entertainment lawyer, representing some of Hollywood's most A-list clients, including Tom Hanks, Matt Damon, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Denzel Washington. Denzel, open invitation to cameo, you heard it here first, ML says with a laugh before revealing that Washington did actually give Suits LA permission to create a photo of him sitting courtside with Ted at a basketball game to use on set. That's a good sign, but I think the jump from photo to cameo is a stretch. The original Suits was a dual lead show with Harvey and Mike, and this is a single lead with an ensemble, Korsh explains. Ted works side by side with his best friend, criminal lawyer Stuart Lane, that's played by The Walking Dead's Josh McDermott, whom he started the Black Lane firm with 15 years ago. They oversee promising protégés Rick Dodson, played by Brian Greenberg, and Erica Rollins, played by Lex Scott Davis, who are both vying for the company's coveted title of head of entertainment. Loyalties will be tested, romantic tension will burn, emotional bombs will be dropped, files will be thrown onto desks, and of course, cases will be argued and closed in the titular corporate fashion. But despite its built-in, newly expanded audience and obvious potential, Suits LA was actually created as a completely different show. I had written the script that is now Suits LA during the pandemic, and it was not originally in the Suits universe, Korsh reveals. It was originally meant to be a new universe about agents in Hollywood. NBC passed on developing that show, but then Suits hit Netflix and everything changed. The creator first realized something big was happening when he started getting messages from people he hadn't heard from in years, saying their child or brother or mother or insert family member or random acquaintance here was binge-watching Suits. Once it was the 7th or 8th text I got within 2 weeks, I was like, this is a weird coincidence, Korsh says with a laugh. The Suits resurgent hit its peak during the writers and actors strikes last year, and once the strikes ended, Korsh finally got the call from NBC he had been expecting. They were like, look, if we bring this script into the Suits universe, we can do it, Korsh says, and I thought it was a great idea. With a little creative editing, he changed the characters from agents to lawyers, and LA Suits was born. It was a roller coaster, but one Korsh had ridden before. The creator had just started his writing career when he wrote the Suits pilot as a spec script solely to help him get a job on any show that would hire him. I didn't even write it to sell it, let alone get it made into a series, let alone have it remade in 5 or 6 languages. And now we're doing this spinoff, he says. At the time, Korsh had written what he knew. Because I had been an investment banker, the characters were actually investment bankers, he reveals. But when, to his shock, USA Network was interested in developing his Suits pilot, they asked him to make the series a procedural. Ultimately, Korsh felt a law office was a better fit for that premise, and looking back on it now, he says, the show benefited from it originally being investment bankers because I combined their roles into a hybrid of what lawyers do and what investment bankers do. Therefore, the original Suits was a different kind of law show. In Suits LA, I was originally setting out to make a show about agents, and now I'm making a show about lawyers, so it's going to make it a very different kind of law show again. A new legal team, Suits Up. Right now, the cast of Suits LA is struggling, ironically, with their suits. At their EW cover shoot, the actors are suiting up in their characters' clothes, but unlike their on-screen alter egos, it's not yet a natural fit. Greenberg attempts to knot his tie 5 times before costumer Jocelyn Kwan steps in. McDermott buttons and rebuttons the vest of his 3-piece suit multiple times while looking in the mirror and brushing his beard. Davis was filming late the night before, so she's still waking herself up while finishing getting ready in her trailer. And Amel slides his phone in his pants pocket only to realize the bottom is cut open so his phone drops down to his shoe. When audiences meet ML's Ted Black in the Suits LA premiere, he's also struggling, but not with pocketless pants. He's struggling as a leader, ML says, as he leans back in his chair just outside of Ted's swanky office, wearing personalized black Crocs that he knows Ted would never be caught dead in. Sometimes he can get so driven and so focused on what's in front of him or the next battle to win that he loses sight of his relationships with people closest to him. And that's what really manifests in the pilot. Amel teases that while the show begins with Ted in a very, very solid relationship with 2 of his closest people at his firm, by the end, they are elsewhere. McDermott adds that the firm is also at a quote-unquote breaking point, and his character Stuart is right in the middle of it. While Ted and Stuart are lifelong friends, they're really more like brothers, McDermott says. Conflict over the legacy of their business leads to conflict between the 2 partners. Ted doesn't think that there's anything wrong with their relationship at all. I think Stuart might disagree, Amel teases. Meanwhile, there's another banter-filled inter-office political war going on between the firm's promising up-and-comers, Rick and Erica. Greenberg describes Rick as the moral compass of the show, a role he knows well after playing many similar characters throughout his career, including One Tree Hill fan-favorite teen heartthrob Jake Jagielski. I'm such an a-hole in real life. I'm just a great actor, I guess, he jokes about his good guy trend. But with Suits LA, Greenberg's finally playing a grown-up man, and he's enjoying portraying Rick's struggle to keep his integrity in a town of snakes and his morality in the most immoral business. The actor thinks Rick is also fighting for Ted's soul as well, because he could go either way. Emil agrees. Ted's very much looking to win at all costs, and Rick is looking to win, but maybe not at all costs. That comes back to bite Ted, in the case of Rick. Rick's main competition at the firm is Erica. They begin the season at the same level in the office hierarchy, but they're jockeying for the same promotion, and Greenberg calls their rivalry juicy, combative, and playful. Davis says Erica, whom she describes as brilliant, savvy, witty, and loyal, firmly believes she's better for the job. If he gets it, she believes he only got it because he's a man, she explains, Erica is fighting for the things that she deserves in this male-dominated space. She's playing hardball with the guys, for sure. The L-word Generation Q alum loves bringing Erica's calculated and meticulous code-switching to life and how her wardrobe, as the only female series regular, visually represents Erica's constant battle to be seen as one of and better than the guys, with a combination of masculine and feminine pieces. The Suits LA stars have watched a varying amount of Suits episodes, and while Davis says she pulled inspiration from the original ladies, she's always conscious about not making Erica a caricature of something that has already been done. The rest of the cast feels the same. Greenberg watched the pilot before he auditioned and then decided not to watch any more episodes. "I don't want to do what they did. I want this to be our own show," he says. This isn't the first attempt at a Suits spinoff, but Korsh has already learned what not to do when expanding the universe. After Pearson, with original series star Gina Torres bringing her titular boss to the dark world of Chicago politics, was canceled after only 10 episodes in 2019. That series debuted as a backdoor pilot in the Suits season 7 finale, but it took the network a year to commit to making Pearson, so it ended up being a year and a half between the air date of the original embedded pilot and the second episode, Korsh explains, is one reason why it failed. Even more importantly, "We didn't embrace its similarities to the original Suits," he says. "We made a conscious decision to try to distinguish it in tone. I think the fans were like, this isn't Suits. This is darker and not as funny." McDermott doesn't think that will be an issue with Suits LA. The actor made it through the first season of Suits in a binge watch before he even knew that this spinoff was in development, and he says that reading the pilot script felt like he was enjoying another episode, just with different characters. That said, familiar faces will return. As the series goes, you're going to discover that there is some crossover with the history of the characters in this show and some of the Suits characters, Korsh says. One of those characters has already teased his highly anticipated return to the franchise. Last month, in a not-so-cryptic Instagram video set to the original Suits theme song, Mac showed off Harvey's monogrammed shirt sleeve before literally stepping into the character's designer shoes again. He captioned the post, "When an old friend is in need, it's time to take care of things and make those very things right." ML seemingly confirmed Mac's appearance in the spinoff by commenting on the post, "The bat signal does work, but it's more than a cameo." NBC Now confirms to Entertainment Weekly that Mac is a recurring guest star, and Korsh reveals that the Suits crossover will first be teased with a big hint in the premiere. You'll notice behind the desk there's a picture of young Ted Black with what can only be a young Harvey Specter, so there's clearly a history between the two characters. "We came up together in the DA's office," ML explains of Mock's role. "I am very much a fan of his character, and I think that dynamic is something the viewers will really enjoy." While Suits LA also reunites many of the behind-the-scenes crew, including writers, producers, and directors, Korsh says he has no desire to make it Suits Season 10, though he acknowledges that's what some fans may want. "While at some point we might do a Suits movie and that could be fun, for the most part, I finished telling the story of those characters," he says. "But I wasn't able to finish saying what I wanted to say about the Suits universe, so this is meeting a whole new group of characters and exploring their dynamics, their passions, their fears, and their hopes and their dreams. It's fun going back to the beginning of something again. This time, no one's pretending to be a lawyer, but there's still a secret being kept from the other characters. Ted Black has a past. Something happened that made him move out to LA and become an entertainment lawyer," Korsh says. While viewers knew Mike's secret from the start, Ted's past in New York, which lines up with the beginning of Suits, is a mystery that will be revealed over the course of the first season through flashbacks. Expect 5 to 10% of the show to take place in the past, says the showrunner, which gives the show a different flavor than the original. Arrow alum ML knows a thing or two about telling a story across two timelines via flashbacks, given his 8-season run as DC Comics character Oliver Queen, aka the Green Arrow. When asked about the parallels between his new and former roles, he laughs. Aside from the fact that we shot the pilot in Vancouver, where Arrow was filmed, and the first scene that I shot was with the guy that had a huge arc as a prison guard on Arrow, it does feel a bit similar, ML agrees. Not to mention Arrowverse villain Matt Letcher is playing Ted's father. When I heard Matt Letcher was playing my father, I knew immediately he had to be evil, ML says. Thankfully, the actor has avoided cumbersome flashback wigs on this series, so far at least. They tried for a brief moment in the pilot. "Should you have sideburns?" he recalls. "I went to the director, Victoria Mahoney. I'm dying in these things." And she just went, "Say less," and peeled them off. So no wigs, no beards. I worked at a federal level in the flashbacks, so I'm not in as nice of suits. But Ted is broken from this whole other life and personal situation that he shares with literally no one. That sounds heavy, but ML promises that Suits LA is most importantly all about having fun. Are there serious subject matters in Suits LA? Yeah, he acknowledges. There's the death of a parent, serious criminal activity, a murder trial, betrayal. But there's also fun and entertainment and fashion and inside jokes for people that live in Los Angeles. But what about romance? Suits was known for its two main slow burn, will they or won't they relationships, and one mysterious can opener, Harvey and Donna, played by Sarah Rafferty, and Mike and Rachel, played by Meghan Markle before she married Prince Harry and became the Duchess of Sussex. So will Suits LA bring the proverbial heat in that department as well? Yeah, spoiler alert, ML deadpans before adding, all the time, with everyone, everyone's in play. Davis agrees, especially when it comes to her character's potential love interests. It's possible to see something romantic with Erica and just about everybody in this show. She's just that person, the actor says. I asked our creator, Aaron, and he's like, I don't know. We're all going to find out together. Thankfully, Suits LA wastes no time in getting to the good stuff. We set up in the pilot some will-they-won't-they course reveals, and then over the course of the first few episodes, there's a triangle. There's a separate will-they-won't-they. There's a separate have-they. We set up all these dynamics. I don't know if they'll be as slow-burny as the original Suits, should we be so lucky to last that long. Only time and seemingly ratings will tell how long Korsh has to tell his Suits LA story, though he's setting his sights higher than simply matching the original series' 9-year run. When I first started writing, what defined success for me would have just been getting on a writing staff, and I've gone so far beyond that it's crazy, the creator says. But now my definition of success is, if I don't create a character that changes the makeup for the British royal family, I feel like I failed. That's a goddamn high bar to set, but you bet your ass he's done it before. That was from their 2025 preview, and it was Case Reopened, the unexpected story behind the making of Suits LA. It was by Sydney Buxbaum. And this isn't technically Entertainment Weekly content in my mind. It's from their website, but there's a note that it's paid content for NBC. I do think it's interesting, though. An inside look at The Americas, NBC's stunning 10-part nature docuseries. NBC's The Americas from the producers of Planet Earth takes viewers on an awe-inspiring journey across the entirety of North and South America. Again, this is paid content for NBC. You'd know you're onto something special when you leave Tom Hanks speechless. From BBC Studios' Natural History Unit, the creators of the critically acclaimed and multi-Emmy award-winning Planet Earth and Blue Planet present The Americas, a 10-part nature docuseries narrated by none other than two-time Academy Award winner Tom Hanks. We were looking at some footage of army ants in South America, and Tom's jaw was on the floor, says Mike Gunton, executive producer of The Americas. The Americas is an epic journey spanning more than 8,700 miles from the top of the Arctic to the tip of Antarctica, across the supercontinent comprising North and South America, over the vast expanse of land between the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans, touching nearly everything in between. But Gunton, a legendary filmmaker whose work includes Life and Planet Earth 2, hesitates to use the term nature documentary. It's more of an experience, like taking the most extraordinary safari of your life, he explains. If we get it right, we'll transport you and make you look at your relationship with nature and your fellow creatures in a different way. In just the first episode, viewers will witness a duel between wild stallions, a bald eagle barrel-rolling in mid-air to protect its turf from aggressive ospreys, and a mother bear teaching her cubs how to climb trees and find berries. The action only ramps up from there. Most other projects like this will focus on a particular animal or just one region, Gunton notes. We're the first to take on this entire massive subcontinent and all the romantic places within, like the Wild West, Patagonia, the Gulf Coast, and the Amazon. One of the great joys of our work in this series is our ability to show Americans a world they think they know and then surprise them. Through it all, the team behind The Americas gets unprecedented views of nature in its rawest form. Using the most cutting-edge filming technology and the latest scientific research, The Americas turns its lens on never-before-seen moments, from a pod of blue whales diving into the ocean depths to a family of raccoons living among the hustle and bustle of New York City. We're known for getting the camera close to these animals, which is not as simple as it looks, Gunton says. That's what gives off that thrilling feeling of immersion, of finding yourself in the head of that animal. There are four quote-unquote cards for us to take a look at that answer a couple questions, and these are going to tell us more about The Americas. It's premiering Sunday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on NBC, and streaming the next day on Peacock. And it says, don't worry, there are still plenty of breathtaking surprises awaiting for you to discover yourself. So these cards, the first one is Who Will Narrate The Americas? This breathtaking nature docuseries is narrated by Tom Hanks, a North American treasure in his own right. The actor was wowed by the footage that Gunton and his team collected and more than happy to lend his friendly, insightful voice to The Americas' great adventure. How was The Americas filmed? 5 years in the making, across more than 180 expeditions, the innovative filmmakers behind The Americas used drones and other revolutionary techniques to immerse themselves in nature. Some of the technology, such as that used to simulate a whale's eye view, took multiple years to develop. North and South America are home to the largest variety of life on the planet, and these dedicated filmmakers sought to capture that diversity in all its glory. Who did the score for The Americas? An incredible docuseries deserves an incredible score. So it's no wonder that the team behind The Americas recruited Grammy and Oscar-winning composer Hans Zimmer for the job, Zimmer's team's original score embodies the sweeping and stirring atmosphere of the filmmaker's awe-inspiring footage. It's perfectly suited to capture the epic nature, no pun intended, of the Americas and enhances the already spectacular viewing experience. And our last question, what makes the Americas so distinct? With the Americas, executive producer Mike Gunton set out to fully capture a seemingly endless swath of natural beauty. Magnificent scenes include a mother bear descending a perilous mountain face, cubs in tow, burrowing owls in the suburbs, and a close-up look at one of nature's greatest former mysteries, sperm whale diving. The magic of the Americas lies in its stunning exploration of every biome across North and South America. That was an inside look at the Americas, NBC's stunning 10-part nature docuseries, and it was paid content for NBC. That wraps us up for our time this week. I'm sad every time I say that. Thank you all for listening. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This has been Entertainment Weekly, and I've been reading from their website, EW.com. Please come back next week, and I'll be reading from their website again. But until then, goodbye.